Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.
The comprehensive economic sanctions that were introduced to Iraq in 1990 were perfectly acceptable at that time. They were legal, they were carried out by the Security Council as a natural reaction to an act of aggression which took place through Iraq's invasion into Kuwait. But what was legal then is no longer legal now. And why do I say this? Because we now have volumes, feet, meters, whatever you want, however you want to measure it, evidence of illegality. Evidence that this red line of demarcation has been crossed, where a political objective that was justified has been outweighed by the impact of that political objective. And we see no sign that there is a sensitivity to this. In fact, let me carry you through now a little bit more systematically through a story that really isn't anything that will make you feel good. It will make you feel very bad. It makes me feel bad every time I repeat the story. But these comprehensive economic sanctions were meant to bring about change. Change of the behavior of a government. And after 11 years, that government is the most stable government in the Middle East, while the people that were meant to be protected are in dire straits and are in deep trouble. Comprehensive economic sanctions really stripped the sovereignty of Iraq. The right to manage resources was taken away. A bank account is maintained by a French bank, the Banque Nationale de Paris. The United Nations manages the resources. A capital and recurrent budget that any nation needs, yours, mine, every community needs, doesn't exist for Iraq. All that Iraq has for 11 long years is a commodity supply program to meet the minimum, the sheer minimum, and I'll talk a little bit about this oil for food program as I go through my presentation, is all that there is in terms of maintaining a tiny fraction of normalcy in that country. There is also no foreign investment. There's no permission to rehabilitate the oil industry, the lifeline for Iraqis. And the approach is a band-aid approach. You're allowed to fix, but you're not allowed to replace. You're not allowed to modernize. You're not allowed to create new institutions. And the end result, you can imagine what it is. 65, 75, I'm not sure what the real figure is, but in that order of magnitude is the unemployment rate. We have created in 11 years a massive society of welfare recipients. The longest, I don't think there's any country on earth, we are about to create another one now, and that is the longest soup line that probably has ever existed. 23 million people that once a month are getting a food basket through the humanitarian program of the United Nations. Paid for, however, entirely by the government of Iraq, by the oil money. Now, let me just pause here before I carry on and say, when you hear me, please do not think that A, I'm an apologist for a dictator, I'm not. Or B, that you think I'm a fanatic, I'm not. Or that you even may think on the basis of my critical objections towards the United States government that I'm anti-American. To be anti-US policy doesn't make somebody anti-American. I think that must be understood. (Clears throat) what we are seeing, and what I painfully saw myself during the 17 months that I lived in Baghdad and traveled in Iraq extensively, from the Kurdish north to the Shia south, I was often on the road. I wanted to be a UN representative who wasn't just a mechanical manager. I wanted to be a decent, honest manager, of course, like my predecessor, but I also wanted to be an interpreter. I thought that a United Nations civil servant was allowed to be an honest interpreter, and I had a bitter lesson to learn. Because for the 30 years that I served before elsewhere, we were always allowed to speak our mind, but the subject was harmless. And suddenly I find myself in Iraq in a highly political environment, and I thought I was allowed to portray to the Security Council and to the UN community in New York and to the missions, to the governments, as honestly as I was capable, together with my colleagues, what the reality was on the ground. And I was not allowed to do that. I will expand on this a little bit later. But what I wanted to say by closing that part that deals with the effects of a wrong policy, comprehensive economic sanctions, that a massive social transformation has taken place in Iraq. Iraq used to have a strong, well-recognized, well-appreciated middle class in the Middle East. There was even a saying, some of you may have read it, Egyptians like to talk. Lebanese like to print. Iraqis like to read. So you found in many houses, you found libraries, you found in the past, and today it is quite different. You can see a house of a professor empty. Why? Because on Fridays you can see in the market why. Many Iraqis had to sell their heirlooms, their property, in the market to make ends meet. And therefore it is possible, I've seen it, I've experienced it, you can go into a house, the house is more or less empty because everything has been sold. Instead, and this is the social transformation part, you have a small economic mafia that has joined a political leadership that goes to bed at night, and if they have any god they pray to, it will be the god of sanctions. They will be looking forward to more of it because they benefit from it. The middle class has been disseminated, deprofessionalized, emigrated, not replaced, and there is this new group that is connected to the powerhouse, to politics, that has everything one could wish to have in terms of material goods. Don't be misled, I beg you. Don't be misled when you see newsreels, films that show a glittering Baghdad. Yes, it exists. There is no glittering Basra, none in Mosul, none in Kirkuk, certainly none in the rural areas. And what you see in Baghdad is one or two streets, a few hotels, a few restaurants, which nobody except a tiny, tiny percentage, a fraction of a percentage, can really afford. So the sociological implications of a wrong policy are absolutely devastating. And then, under international pressure, under awareness also in the Middle East, among Arab governments, gradually the pressure on the US and the British in the Security Council intensified. They had to come up with something new. What was that new? The new was termed and introduced in June of this year in the Security Council as smart sanctions. Smart sanctions, I said this morning in UBC, if it's as of June of this year smart, I want to know what it was the previous 11 years. And certainly not smart. It was stupid, as somebody said. And it was not, I wouldn't call it that. I would call it extremely painful and destructive. And the smart sanctions as a concept, not a bad concept. Targeted sanctions, focused sanctions, intelligent sanctions, this is all fine. But what was introduced in the UN Security Council is totally consistent, I know what I'm saying, is totally consistent with the entire punitive approach that has been chosen to deal with Iraq. Because what looks good is malicious, and I want to explain why. You will read about smart sanctions. The British ambassador to the UN will tell you, we are freeing all restrictions on civilian goods that come into Iraq. That sounds good. I would welcome that, even though it falls far short of what Iraq really needs. What Iraq needs today is a kickstart of the economy, an opportunity for people to work again, to earn a living, to get that dignity that we all need in our lives, to get self-realization, to fend for themselves. That already isn't possible. No foreign investment, no return of the budget responsibility to the government of Iraq. That is serious. That is not acceptable. But it doesn't allow the word malicious that I used. The word malicious comes in when the governments, these two governments, are saying, we have removed all the restrictions on civilian goods to come into Iraq. And therefore, if the Iraqi people continue to suffer after this, then it is entirely the fault of the government of Iraq. That's malicious. Why? Because concurrently with these shifts in the approach, the proposal was that Iraq should be completely isolated, hermetically closed off, cocooned, in other words, so that not a barrel of oil can leave Iraq other than the oil that is going through the United Nations programs. And at the moment, Iraq exports, call it illegally, call it extra-legally, exports oil into Turkey in particular, also into Syria, and also into Jordan. And Iraq needs to do that, because you heard me say earlier, I used the word punitive approach to Iraq. Well, this sanction imposed on Iraq is part of this punitive approach, because Iraq didn't get a single dollar to pay for this recurrent cost for the civil service, for teachers, for the upkeep of hospitals, the upkeep of schools, of bridges, of roads, and so on. Nothing. So how can you run that nation without any resource? So the government was forced to do that. Maybe it would have done it anyway. Yes, they're using some of that money for the building of palaces, for luxury items, all not good. They should invest that elsewhere. They should not waste it in that way. But the point is, they need 90% plus to run a nation. And if you look for a moment at the highest amount that I ever found in the press of extra money pocketed by the government of Iraq, then it comes, the highest figure I have seen is $3 billion. Now, if you take $3 billion and you divide that by 23 million people, you're getting an amount of $130 per person per year. That's all there is as extra income. Surely he cannot, that Saddam Hussein cannot afford to use a large percentage of that money for purposes other than financing and maintaining the civilian infrastructure. I was fascinated that two nights ago in Seattle, I met a gentleman at a dinner who worked for the local administration. I asked him, what is your recurrent budget in Kings County where he works? It's a population of 1.7 million. He told me $2.9 billion per year. So there is a population of 1.7 that has $2.9 billion a year, while here are $23 million people who have $3 billion if they have that much. So I'm amazed that with this amount, you can even have what Iraq is now having in terms of running a local administration, a local infrastructure. So the smart sanctions are smart for those who are introducing it, but not smart for the people who have to accept it. And I'm very glad that the Russian government in the Security Council for once had the courage to say no and issue a veto. Because until now, no secret, the UN Security Council members were really pressured and pushed into accepting the position of the number one spokesperson in the Security Council, that's the US. I want to remind you here that when the sanction resolution 687 of 1991 was adopted, it was Mr. James Baker, who was foreign secretary at the time, and he writes in his memoirs something which is just amazing. He said, when this resolution was debated in the Security Council, we went to our friends to ensure that they would accept our draft. When they didn't, we started pressuring. When they didn't, we intensified pressure. And when they didn't, we started bribing. Now, I can tell you, I really admire him for his frankness, as I despise him for the content of his frankness. So I want to conclude that part of smart sanctions, that they are neither smart nor intelligent. They are malicious and they're inhuman, and they would simply intensify the suffering of the Iraqi people if adopted. Well, here is then my program, the program for which I was responsible, the Oil for Food program, a small fig leaf, a small smokescreen, to try and show that you had a modicum of moral fiber left in dealing with Iraq. I didn't know that when I accepted that post. I thought this, at least taking over from my predecessor, I wasn't surprised he gave up, because this is exhausting when you are also psychologically, when you go into a post like this. And I thought, well, 13 months in that post for him, that was enough. Now let me come with a little bit of naive optimism into this and carry on where he left it. Well, I wasn't there very long before I realized what kind of a program I had inherited. First of all, I told you already, we were not expected to speak. Mr. James Rubin, the spokesman of the State Department, said this man in Baghdad has been appointed to work, not to speak. This was an official statement he made when I began to play the second role that I wanted to play, which was that of an interpreter. So the Oil for Food program, I began to realize, was so totally inadequate, particularly in the initial phases. The first year and a half, that program had all that it had at its disposal, was $1.3 billion, out of the $2.2 billion that they were allowed to produce and sell as far as oil is concerned. 1.3, with a population of about 21 and a bit million people at that time, translates into $113 per person per year. That's all that was theoretically available. What actually arrived for the Iraqi people during that period was half. So roughly $69, $70, just about that, was available. And you can check these figures. They are not invented. They are absolutely correct. And it moved on into the next phases. It was equally inadequate, a little bit better. But what is the double amount that became available? So it was not 200, not 113 during the following three phases up to phase six, but it was $220 or so dollars. That isn't enough by any standard to meet even the minimum physical needs of the people. And I said, as I said to you earlier, don't you agree with me when I say that life, and we in the UN in Baghdad kept saying that, but it fell on deaf ears. We kept saying life is more than just about meeting physical needs. We have to go beyond that. And the Oil for Food program was meant to be temporary and supplementary. Temporary after so many years, supplementary, supplementing to what? To nothing, to very little. to maybe a little bit of local food, but nothing else. So the Oil for Food program is important. Without it, people couldn't at all survive, but it's totally inadequate. And with the figures, and then I will not bombard you with more figures, but let me give you just four figures, three of which were published by the UN. The fourth one could have easily been published because it comes out of the three figures. And then you will see how inadequate, even today, with higher income, because of not because of more volume of oil pump, but because of more higher oil prices, the situation is. $44.4 billion is what Iraq earned from the beginning of the Oil for Food program in December of 96. By mid-July of this year, that was the amount that was recorded in the books. That is the legally earned amount, 44.4. Actually available for the humanitarian situation were 26.3 billion. The difference is, by the way, the amount that goes into what is called the UN Compensation Commission, an amount which is available for governments, for companies and individuals that think they have a claim because Iraq invaded Kuwait, and they make this claim and they're getting paid out of that fund. So, 26.3 billion for humanitarian supplies. Actually arrived in Iraq during this 4.5 year period, 13.5 billion. If you assume a median population during that period of 22, it's today 23, in the beginning it was less than 22, then all you are getting is an amount of, and I call this, and I'm sure you will agree with that, I call it the $119.70 scandal, because that is the entire amount that Iraqis had for electricity, for water supply, for sanitation, for agriculture, for education, for health, and for food. $119.70. Now, how, I ask you, can a U.S. representative have the courage to go into the Security Council on the 5th of December of last year and look at his colleagues and say to them, the U.S. government is satisfied that the Oil for Food program meets the needs of the Iraqi people? I cannot understand this. And this sort of, that awareness that grew in me slowly, combined with 4 days of nonsensical bombing of Baghdad and other urban areas in 5 weeks after I had arrived in Iraq in December of 98, that was the reason why I resigned. The American State Department and the British Foreign Office, they thought that I resigned because of their pressure. Oh, they don't know me. I am very stubborn, and I wouldn't resign because of pressures from there, because I had the confidence of the U.S. UN Secretary General. So I resigned because of this mismatch, because of the dishonesty with which a program was introduced and justified, and the victimization that took place of people who had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with this political conflict. And I said this, got into trouble in October 1999 for the first time. The New York Times published an interview. Headline was, UN official in Baghdad calls for lifting of economic sanctions. And I, when I saw that in the internet, I said, well, it's now such and such a time. It will take a few hours, and I have calls from New York. And I had calls from New York. And the Secretary General's office said, well, the first ambassador to call was the Kuwait ambassador, who asked the UN whether this signified a change in UN policy. I wish it had, but it of course didn't, and I was reprimanded. I was told to keep my mouth shut and reminded of what James Rubin had said about this man is appointed to work and not to talk. So we have this inadequate program which has barely managed to halt the deterioration of life for the Iraqi people. And what it certainly hasn't done, and that must trouble all of us, it has not done anything to redress the situation for the young, for the children. It hasn't done anything because there's no money, or practically very little money, for the education sector. And as a result, the most innocent and the most the youngest, they are the most affected. They are punished for something that they haven't done. And we are seeing now a young generation growing up into political maturity. And will we be, should we be surprised if, when the sanctions have long been forgotten for Iraq, when there are people in responsible positions who will remember that some outsiders have stolen years of their life which nobody can bring back to them? I don't think so. So here we have a program which is simply inadequate, and it mustn't be allowed to continue. And I keep saying, and this is my next point, I'm moving on quickly now. I don't want to, there must be time for some questions if you have any. But I just want to say this program must not be allowed to carry on. Every day that passes is a day when 147 mothers and fathers lose the most precious thing a mother and father can have, and that is a child. Is it 147? The press sometimes asks me. Maybe not. But this is what we found. This is what UNICEF researched. 5,000 to 6,000 children a month on average. Well, take that as a figure. Is it more? Maybe. Is it less? Possibly. But it's too many. One is too many. And I think we have to make people realize that we are no longer willing to accept that. And when I say to groups in Europe, if you have to make a choice between breaking international law or breaking sanctions, go ahead and break sanctions. So that is the situation. The big problem that we face, I don't think when the UN Charter was written, anyone anticipated to have ever such complicated international conflicts as the one we see in Iraq. And therefore, international law that was written during those years after the Second World War, international law isn't prepared to handle. It's too intangible. It makes it very easy for arbitrary applications. Article 39 of the UN Charter says you can impose sanctions when there is an act of aggression or a threat to international security. These are two very intangible, loose terms that can be interpreted in this way or in that way. And with the overwhelming power of the Americans in the Security Council, it's interpreted in their way. And I think it prompted Mr. Exworthy some time ago to say, he reminded us that sanctions should be implemented with the international community's objectives in mind. And then he added, and not implemented in accordance with the national interest of individual members. He was very kind and discreet. I wouldn't have been. I would have left the S off and said individual member, because it was a clear reference to the U.S. So international law isn't helpful. I could go into many other details to show that. Resolutions are sloppily formulated purposely. Admit it. Again, the U.S. and British, I'm sorry I refer so often to the U.S. and the British representatives, but they are behind the problem that makes me come to Vancouver and makes me travel. They said sloppily formulated resolutions. No, this is constructive ambiguity. What a term. Constructive ambiguity, wonderful. I keep saying ambiguity is correct. Constructive is definitely not correct. So here we have that is being exploited. And I'm moving on to another subject very, very, very briefly, and that is what the media are doing. The media are fed inadequate information. There's a lot of sensationalism here in portraying. You are seeing it these days with anthrax, with terrorism, Somebody coined the term mass-induced hysteria. Well, there is a little bit of that. We should be fearful, but it's so badly represented. There's so much conjecture. There's a possibility that an attack on Iraq may be possible because of the link between terrorism, anthrax, and Iraq without any evidence. If there's evidence, no question, we must look for the perpetrators. Justice must prevail, not revenge, as it is planned. So we have... We have many examples of a misrepresented Iraq. Iraq is seen as if there was only one person living there. There are 23 million people that are good people. They're as good as you and I. And they are sincere people. What do they want? I spend days on university campuses in Baghdad. I've been back 4 times. And the message you're getting is so moving. But the bottom line is, please, understand, we would like to live and study in peace. And they don't have that. If you have every day the uncertainty hanging over you, what comes next, you can imagine what kind of climate this creates in universities that are really at the moment not worth the name that they are centers of higher learning. It's pitiful. From the high school to the primary school to the university, it's just appalling what you see when you go there. No paper, no blackboard. Computers are on the forbidden list, cannot come in. Teachers get $5, 10,000 dinar, $5 a month. A home economics professor who studied in the US, whom I know personally, she started her salary 30 years ago with $350 to $400. Today she gets 19,000 dinar. That's about $10 a month. She has hardly clothes to change. She has a fairly empty house. The food is very inadequate despite improvements, I must concede. Medicine and food has improved over the years. So the media doesn't show that. The media shows Saddam Hussein, a monster, involved in weapons of mass destruction. No explanation offered, no evidence is offered. And if you, however, listen to people who have lived there, who have seen, who are arms inspectors, other than Mr. Butler, who has a deep, deep axe to grind with the Russians and the Iraqis for the way he was treated by them, the Russians who didn't want him to continue, the Iraqis who said, listen, in 4 years, Mr. Butler, you have come to us. We have told you what we have. You haven't found any evidence whatsoever that what we said to you doesn't correspond to what you found. It's enough. We don't want to be humiliated. We do not want to carry on with this. They were never thrown out, by the way. Another piece of media misrepresentation when you read that they were thrown out of Iraq. They were not thrown out. They left at their own volition. In fact, we were in the same building. We were the UN humanitarian workers. We were the bunny huggers. The arms inspectors were called the cowboys. The cowboys left on the 16th of December, 1998, in good time, well planned for the bombing. Well, the bunny huggers, the other 660 bunny huggers, we stayed behind. So, the story about arms situation of Iraq is totally misrepresented. And there is convincing evidence available. And yet it's not shown. It's more fashionable to pretend, and you can imagine why. If you don't show Iraq as a villain, then you have no more business to be in the Gulf. You have no more business to be in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. You have no more business to continue to overarm an already overarmed part of the world. How do we get out of this? I think I want to end by just offering what today to the editorial page editor of The Sun was not very convincing. But first of all, I'm not here to deliver a blueprint for how to get out of this, but I can portray to you how it is, and that may help to find a way to get out of it. But the United Nations, let me just say that, was created as a house of dialogue, not a house of confrontation. The United States government has converted the United Nations into a house of confrontation. And that I regret very, very deeply. That must be changed. Today, the UN must again become a house of dialogue. And I want to just say, investment into human security as distinct of military security is by far the better option. And human security to me means reducing poverty, investment in women in particular, in countries that are... that are so vulnerable. That should be the medium and longer term strategy. That's what I learned as a UN official over 30 long years. The best protection for conflict is human security. Where are the major areas of conflict in our world today? Not in Norway, not in Sweden, not in Canada. You are in the annual Human Development Report published by the United Nations. You are very close to the top if you're not at the top. I know that there were NGOs in Canada who were so angry that you were shown at such a high level that you even wanted to make a court case out of it. I want you to know everything is relative, and Canada is far, far ahead to most other countries in terms of human rights-mindedness, in terms of giving women a better chance. And that is the real security. That's what protects us, not B-52s.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.